And welcome to the Linux Journal Insider Podcast for May 2011. This is issue 205, Security. Hey, Kyle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm just laughing because I'm hearing, I heard a little companion, another co-host that's
right,
vying for my job here.
We do have a guest host this month. It's Beans. My family parakeet is in my office. And as soon as I started doing the intro music, he started really singing along. So, and he hasn't stopped yet. So anyway, yeah, that's Beans. I actually renamed him. He was Fido, was the name of our parakeet. I thought Beans was a cooler name for a bird. I don't know why.
I'm not sure. It is pretty cool.
Yeah. So, anyway, have you had a good month?
Yeah, it's been a great month. It's been really rainy over here. Just to talk about the weather a little bit. So it's weird because February was almost like summertime over here, but now it's kind of rainy and it feels like, I guess, the rest of the country normally feels. It's weird.
That's weird. Here it's cold and we've had like zero snow all year. It's really bizarre. But I could whine and complain about it. But instead, I'm going to whine and complain about unity. Now, not like brotherly unity and togetherness and stuff. But the Ubuntu new GNOME interface desktop thing that used to just be on their netbooks. Have you seen Unity?
I have only recently finally seen it on a netbook. I bought my wife a netbook just recently, and I said, well, you know, I might as well try out the netbook remix Ubuntu release, because maybe it'll run a little bit better on the netbook, stuff like that. So I tried it out, and if that's what Unity is, it was just strange. Like, all the icons were on the side, and I started using it, and I was like, well, but I want to get to the setting. I don't know, it just seemed like, maybe it makes me sound like an old man. Like, I couldn't find any of my buttons, but I don't know. Everything was different. Not in a good way. I don't know.
Yeah, that's actually exactly my experience. I guess it's supposed to save space. It just has the one panel on top, and it's not a panel. I could get into arguments with people about what to call it. But there's just the one panel-like thing on the top and then icons along the side to take advantage of widescreen monitors. I don't see how it saves any room. Now, because when I start GNOME up, the first thing I do is get rid of the bottom panel. You know, I just want to have one panel. So adding the icons on the side just wastes room. And then, like, what would be the start menu or the Ubuntu menu, whatever the menu is weird now. There's not, like, a hierarchy of stuff. It's like you search for, I don't know. I don't get it. I just don't understand it.
Settings. Like, I wanted to go into some settings, and there's ways to do all this stuff, but it just seemed... Like, if I'm going to hand this over to my wife, who's now used to the regular Ubuntu desktop, it's like learning all the stuff all over again. So I just installed regular Ubuntu on the netbook instead.
Yeah. Now, the one nice thing, I played with the Alpha 3 version of Netty Narwhal 11.04, and at the login screen, you can actually choose to use Classic GNOME. And then it's Classic. So that's cool. What I don't know is if you uninstall Ubuntu, if it just does the Classic GNOME by default. I kind of hope that's it. So with a, you know, quick little apt-get kung fu, I can get it back to how we used to like it uphill, both ways in the snow.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm hoping for. But Unity, I'm not a fan, and people are kind of hearing me whine about it. So we'll see. When it comes out, I am going to give it another fair shake, but I'm not very confident that it's gonna go well.
Yeah.
But there's more. It's the security issue. It's not the Unity issue. So I'm going to talk about an article from Raphael Mudge. It's live fire security testing with Armitage and Metasploit. And just saying the word Metasploit just gives me joy. So it's neat because instead of securing your network and talking about how to build a network that's secure. These are tools to attack yourself. These are network masochism tools, I suppose. But they're designed so that you can test your network by attacking it. And it's kind of neat because they test a whole bunch of different exploits. It's just a really great set of tools. And, you know, Raphael goes through and talks about how to do all these different things. I mean, it's, you know, I can't tell you much more other than it's, you basically try to hack through your system and see how it works.
Yeah, it's a really nice guide for someone who, because if you've ever tried to use Metasploit without hardly any tutorials or anything, it can be a little daunting using the framework by itself on the command line if you're coming at it just completely green. But this article does a good job of explaining, if you want to do some basic penetration testing with Metasploit, how to use this Armitage front end to pick some targets, how to automatically exploit services on certain machines. Pretty much a nice little walkthrough on how to use this, especially, like I said, if you've used Metasploit in the past or tried to use it and you weren't that big of a fan of the way the interface works, this article would be a good thing to use to kind of get back into the fold here. So.
Yeah. And it manages lots of different things. I mean, it does, you know, dictionary tester, you know, testing for password security and things like that. So it's great. And it's a great way to learn about how to test your network security. And like you said, it's a great walkthrough. So if it's not something you're comfortable with or done before, it's a great starting point to get into the feel of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and the first article I'm going to talk about is called Virtual Security, Combating Actual Threats. And this is written by Jeremiah Bowling. And this article talks about security from the perspective of having virtual servers. So the article actually, to be honest, the article really is a decent primer on overall virtualization infrastructure. Because, you know, while the article is going to go over things like physical security for the host and how to lock down the hosts that your VMware KVM Xen guests are running on, it goes over just a general good guide of best practices for how to set up virtualization infrastructure, from anywhere from how to deal with disk infrastructure, disaster recovery. He talks about how to lock down the hypervisor and just how in general to set up and not really configure your hypervisor, but best practices for hypervisors, and all the way drilling down to security of your guests, like your VMs, and how to set up monitoring and alerting, and finally even talks a little bit about network security as well for your virtual networks, you know, bridging versus NATing and things like that. So overall, you know, a good guide for security, but in my mind, a nice guide for best practices for virtualization too.
And what's nice about it, one of the problems, this isn't really a problem, but one of the things you have to be careful of, especially with things like ESX or ESXi, they're so simple to install and get going that you do, you know, it's easy to overlook things like best practices, you know, security or just how to set it up so that it's efficient and works well. Because it'll just, I don't want to say out of the box, but once you install it, it goes so smooth. The toughest part is usually figuring out how that virtual switch works, because that's kind of a brain scratcher or head scratcher for a while. But once you figure that out, you can just leave it and let it go. So it's a nice way that you can get a good start with your virtualization environment. It's really good. And so you can keep it secure, but like you said, also just do things wisely.
It basically helps you build a better virtual server.
Yes, and speaking of better, thank you for that segue, Kyle. My next article is it's by Mike Horn, talking about building a better firewall. And I have to admit, now this article is talking about building a Linux highly available firewall using Firewall Builder, which we've talked about Firewall Builder, I think, actually even in the podcast before. It's a really neat graphical tool if you're not comfortable with IP tables and such the like. But what this is specifically talking about is creating a highly available firewall. And I have to admit, I've never done this. Now, in my defense, where our particular network, if I have a firewall go down, well, then we're just offline until I fix it. You know, I mean, we're not going to spend the money on having, you know, high availability in our firewall. But it's neat that Firewall Builder supports this, because it's the kind of thing where writing rules for such a thing is just beyond my abilities. And Firewall Builder gives you a great graphical way to manage this. It's neat. I mean, I honestly don't think much. And maybe, you know, you've worked in companies where, you know, bandwidth and being online is, you know, what you live and breathe by. So possibly this is something that you've done. But it's not something I've had to do, but it's neat to see how it's done. And he goes through and talks about how you do it, how you set it up. It's pretty cool.
Well, the neat thing about this is, you know, most of my practical experience with it, with something like this, is there's been an appliance, like there's been a physical firewall that you buy from a vendor that has these sorts of features. But it's really nice knowing that if you have a Linux machine that can handle the throughput that your firewall needs to handle, that you can set up something, you know, reasonably on the cheap. You know, if you're comfortable with IP tables and you know, set up contract D, which is a nice system for keeping sessions in sync, because that's really the tricky part. The real trick here is the connection tracker or the daemon that they set up to keep track of connection state and synchronize that connection state to the failover firewall, so that if you do have a failure on your first firewall, all the connections can pick right back up on the second firewall without having to be reestablished. So that's probably the key to this. But yeah, this is a really good guide, and it probably saves some organizations some money if you're looking into setting up the highly available firewalls. I recommend going through this tutorial and trying it out on some servers of your own and throwing some traffic through it before you look for some third-party box solutions for this.
Yeah. And that really is the trick with setting up states and actually switching them over is kind of magic. I mean, we do have multiple ISPs, and so I have a dual WAN interface, and I, you know, try to load balance our network usage at the school that I work at. And just establishing states and getting them to work well there is rough. But if you talk about something that's highly available and you actually want those states to switch over, that's rough. I mean, that's a lot of work that's going on behind the scenes. So it's pretty cool that this actually does that.
Yeah, absolutely. Check that out. So the next article that I'm going to talk about is security monitoring and enforcement with CF Engine 3. And this was written by Aleksey Salalikin. And basically what this talks about is, so CF Engine is pretty much one of the first real centralized configuration management tools that made it easy for sysadmin to, as an example, set up a configuration file on a centralized server and make sure that configuration file is pushed out to all of your clients in your network. So it makes it, if you have, you know, a couple hundred or a thousand systems, it makes it super easy, or it makes it way easier to make sure all of those systems are in sync. So this article talks about how to use CF Engine 3, which is still under development, but it talks about how to use syntax in CF Engine 3 for security. And that was something interesting. I hadn't really thought about using a configuration management system for it, at least in this way, but the article goes into things such as using CF Engine in a way almost like a tripwire. So if anyone listening to the podcast isn't familiar with Tripwire, basically Tripwire is software that will create checksums of files that you specify. You can create checksums of most of the major files in your on your system, and it will check to make sure if any of those have changed. So if an attacker comes in and replaces your LS with their version of LS or replaces one of your configuration files, when Tripwire runs next time, you'll get a flag about it. Well, this is basically implementing something similar, only already in CF Engine. So if you're using CF Engine, this would be a really nice way to go to have Tripwire-like functionality. So he talks about how to do that, and talks about how to, you know, just in general, check to make sure that files have changed. You can also check for suspicious file names. So there's a whole section about looking for files that, for example, known rootkits might use, or, you know, I would even talk about, you know, looking for files that have just spaces or directories with spaces in them. A lot of attackers like to hide their payloads by putting they'll put a directory with a simple space in it under temp or var temp, so that a cursory look by a sysadmin, they won't see anything. But if you dig deeper, you'll see that there's this huge directory structure underneath. So this basically talks about how to set up CF Engine 3. Again, it's still in development, but it seems like a really powerful syntax and like I said, an interesting way to use your configuration management to lock down your system, which other than, you know, keeping SSH keys and things like that, and so this even talks about how to check for listening ports using CF Engine, so you can see if anyone's opened up like an IRC server on your machine without you knowing it.
Yeah. That's cool. And, you know, I've never used, and we've talked about this past couple of days, Kyle, I've never used a configuration management tool like CF Engine or Puppet or what was the other one you mentioned?
Chef,
exactly. And that's something I'll be doing this summer. But it sounds like this article is going above and beyond configuration management for sure. So it's a unique way to look at security.
Absolutely.
It's definitely worth reading which leads me into. I wanted to talk to you about reading. Now, you're a pretty smart guy. I assume that you read books. Is that true?
That is true. I do read books.
That is. I also read the backs of shampoo bottles and stuff. Depending on – no, I won't go there. But
well, that's what e-books are for on your phone. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's why you never borrow somebody's smartphone ever. I'm curious your take on e-books. I have many e-book reading devices. I have cell phones. I have in our house we have two Kindles, and I have Sony – a pocket ebook reader that I really, really like. I've read on an Android phone. I've read on an iPhone. At work, I'm actually going to be in charge of managing a bunch of iPads. So I'll be looking at that because I'm sure they'll be reading on those. Have you read much with ebook devices?
You know, to be honest, I haven't used a whole lot of, especially not purpose-built ebook devices. For me, the licensing under a lot of the ebooks out there kind of bothers me. Some vendors of ebooks are better about this, where the licensing is not as restrictive. But in many cases, you're not even really buying a book anymore. You're just sort of – it's almost like licensing software with all of the difficulties that are in that. So, you know, so for now I've been sort of hesitant to get some of the purpose-built ebook devices. Plus, I don't know. Usually when I'm reading a book, I actually like the feel of a tangible book. Plus, even with textbooks, I mean, you could argue that it's really convenient to be able to use a search engine on a textbook, you know, the search for particular terms. For me, I don't know. I just like when I'm reading something that had the tangible physical book in front of me. But that having been said, I have used ebooks like on a cell phone. I found that easy. You know, if you're standing in line or something like that, instead of whipping out Angry Birds or something, I've read a couple public domain books that way. Makes it, you know, just sort of nice and simple if you have 5 or 10 minutes to kill waiting somewhere, having a book in your pocket.
Yeah, and, you know, it is a little frustrating, like you said, with the licensing. DRM with ebooks is a real big problem. You know, most of the books I've purchased have been from Amazon for the Kindle. And if I want to read them on something else, I mean, like, you know, there's Kindle apps for phones and stuff, but if I want to read it, like, on my Sony, I have to rip out the DRM, which I'm sure is against the law, and convert it to, you know, EPUB format so I can put it on there. And I do that, and I don't feel guilty about it because, I bought the book. But it is a frustration. It really is a frustration. And I do still like paperback books. I think it's going to be a good thing for authors. Myself, I still like to collect a lot of books. I just like books. So sometimes I will get an ebook, read it, and then buy the dead tree version so I can put it on my shelf. Just because, right. Like a trophy, you know, I don't put deer heads on my wall, but I put a bunch of books on my shelf that I like, you know, and things like that. So I think there's still, I don't think either one's going away. I don't think that we're going to see the demise of the printed book anytime soon. But I think ebooks are going to be more and more convenient. And they are, they're convenient.
Yeah. Well, and just because the overhead of production's less, you can have a slightly lower price point, at least compared to for new versus new, at least. Now, that's the other thing is the thing about tangible books is that there's this whole submarket for used books. You know, you can go to used bookstores and get, or even online, and get really good deals sometimes on used books. I don't know how much of a marketplace there is, or even you probably would be violating someone's licensing agreement if you sold an ebook after you read it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's any way of, you know, selling or even giving away ebooks when you're done with them legally. So that's definitely a problem. And thankfully, now at first, I was an early adopter. I had the old LCD ebook readers and stuff. And the frustrating thing about those was I lost my train of thought completely.
Well, could you transfer books off of them after you, if you got a new ebook reader? Was that an issue with those?
No. I'm going to have to edit this because I completely lost what I was going to say. Yeah. Oh! The frustrating thing about in the early days of ebooks is that they cost just as much as the printed copy. And you know that it wasn't nearly as expensive to produce because there's no physical materials. But they would cost just as much and sometimes more than the actual book. Thankfully, that's going away. Like, if you look on Amazon, order a book, the Kindle book is almost always, you know, cheap, you know, cheaper enough that at least you don't feel like you're completely being taken advantage of.
See, I wish they would do that. That's my feeling about buying MP3s, is that, you know, I could buy the physical CD for the same cost as buying an MP3 album, but the quality is way more, and I can always rip it down to whatever quality MP3 I want, or FLAC or anything else. I really wish they would price, I've said this a million times before, but I really wish they would price MP3s or just digital music according to quality. Yeah. You know, I'd be way more willing to buy an MP3 album for, if it's, you know, half the quality for half the price.
Yeah. I think, though, MP3 music has beaten the CD. I do think we're going to see CDs really become less and less and less and less common. Already, they're nowhere close to the same purchases. I think we still see much more digital purchases of music now.
Oh, but anyway. It's a shame. Yeah, I just wish they had, you could buy more easily by FLAC or something. Yeah, if the cost for a FLAC was the same as the cost for a CD,
that would make sense.
I'd be all over it. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Well, anyway, and we're kind of old and curmudgeon-y, so maybe.
I want an 8-track.
I like hardcover books. anyway, all right, Kyle. Thank you. We'll let everybody stop listening to our rants about books and dead trees and such. But thank you all for listening to the Linux Journal Insider for May 2011. Be sure to pick up a copy on newsstands in mid-April. Subscribers, if you're listening to this, you probably have a copy in your hand and you were reading along as we were talking. If not, you should have it soon. Next month is our embedded issue, so make sure to tune in again. And don't forget to visit us at www.linuxjournal.com. Kyle, I will talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Okay, let's start. And welcome to the Linux Journal Insider podcast for the 2000. We're going to start over because I forgot what month it is. What month is it?